Next case is United States v. Armendariz. This being a certified case, the government will go first. Counsel for the government may argue.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Chief Judge Stuckey, and may it please the Court. My name is Lieutenant Kimberly Rios, and I, along with Lieutenant Colonel Nick Gannon, we represent the United States. Chief Judge Stuckey, I respectfully request 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Three.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Granted.
This court should reverse the lower court for 3 reasons. First, the search authorization was valid because the executive officer succeeded to command. Second, the good faith exception applies because the agents reasonably believed the executive officer was the acting commander. And third, the lower court erroneously applied MRE 311A3. So the parties may have believed Lieutenant Colonel White was the commander. The record shows complete command devolved to the executive officer under Article 1026, the only regulation governing succession to command, when Lieutenant Colonel White and 300 Marines attached to a separate command, CENTCOM, executing a new mission and gaining a new reporting chain. Because the principles of reasonableness of a search granted by a commander apply to a search granted by an officer who succeeds to command, the search authorization was valid here. Additionally, this court's precedent provides the legal framework to join the 11 circuit courts in their unanimous agreement that the good faith exception can apply to warrants that are void ab initio. As a codification of the good faith exception, this court interpreted MRE 311C3 consistently with Supreme Court precedent in Carter and Chappell, placing the focus of the rule on the reasonable belief of a well-trained officer. This court has also interpreted MRE 311C3A as the adoption of EASL's requirement that the authorizing official must be impartial. Therefore, the good faith exception applies if the agents reasonably believed an impartial commander authorized their request. Because the focus of the good faith exception is not on the character of the Fourth Amendment violation, there's no reason to distinguish between warrants that are constitutionally invalid because they lack a probable cause, jurisdiction, or because command didn't properly devolve. Here, the agents relied in good faith on the search authorization because they knew Lieutenant Colonel White deployed and reasonably believed the executive officer was the commander of the squadron. Moreover, this court should not apply the exclusionary rule because the agents didn't try to circumvent appellee's rights deliberately, recklessly, or with gross negligence. Because the agents acted reasonably, there is no conduct to deter, and any incremental benefits of deterring their conduct does it outweigh the cost to the justice system? Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. How was Major B, a commander or an officer in charge, or anything, when none of the squares were filled in, none of the Navy regs governing succession in command, commanders, or devolution were followed, and she was expressly denied the fundamental concomitance of command, i.e., the ability, the authority to convene courts-martial and to administer non-judicial punishment?
Yes, Your Honor. I have 2 points to your answer. The first is that we believe that under the sole regulation governing succession to command, which is what we are talking about here, we think that Article 1026 of the Navy regulations was satisfied when Lieutenant Colonel White was absent from the squadron when he attached to an entirely separate command under CENTCOM. So because Article 1026 was satisfied, we think that as a matter of law, the executive officer succeeded to command and had courts-martial convening authority. And that's regardless of the
Convened courts-martial despite the fact that she was explicitly denied the authority?
Yes, Your Honor. The record shows that Lieutenant Colonel White subjectively believed that he didn't have the authority to delegate that courts-martial convening authority, and he's right. He has no authority to delegate it. But when the executive officer succeeded to command, when he deployed under an entirely different command, she gained full command authority, including courts-martial convening authority.
Well, that's an interesting proposition. What was she the commander of? There was no unit was set up. She was the commander of what they used to call in the French Army in World War One, the top, the rear. But there's no, what's she commanding? She's not commanding anything.
Yes, Your Honor. We would disagree with that proposition. We think that the executive officer, when she succeeded to command, she was the commander of the squadron. There's no evidence in the record.
Well, then what was he the commander of? The lieutenant colonel.
Lieutenant Colonel White did not deploy with the squadron. We don't think that the record supports that the squadron deployed. What the record shows is that Lieutenant Colonel White attached to a separate command, and he deployed as special purpose MAGTEF.
Well, but aren't orders necessary to carry all this out? And there weren't any.
Well, when Lieutenant Colonel White deployed, I mean, he was acting under orders, and he deployed.
Yeah, they said PCS over, or TDY over here, but all he did was left her a note saying, have fun, and call me every once in a while.
Your Honor, the record shows that he attached to Special Purpose MAGTEF, which fell under Central Command in the Middle East. It does not show that the squadron forward deployed. So under 1026, he was absent from the squadron because the squadron did not deploy. And because he was absent from the squadron under 1026,
along with most of the squadron.
Pardon me, Your Honor?
The bulk of the squadron was over with him, right?
Yeah, so Lieutenant Colonel White.
The numerical bulk of the squadron was over there with him. The remainder was there with her.
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay. So, go ahead.
But the record shows that when Lieutenant Colonel White and the 300 Marines deployed, they didn't deploy as a squadron. They deployed as Special Purpose MAGTEF, Crisis Response Central Command. And
thank
the
you.
Squadron. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Judge Ryan.
Yeah, Counsel, when you talked about the good faith exception, I was just curious. Is it your view that Kalshower and Bunting don't control this case?
When it comes to the good faith exception, Your Honor?
No, when it comes to whether or not, for purposes of granting a search authorization that under MRE 315, that aspect has devolved to her.
If I understand your question correctly, Your Honor, I mean, we do think that MRE 315D1 establishes the reasonableness requirement that is necessary for a commander to issue a search authorization. And Kalshower takes that requirement from 315D1 and applies it to the officer who succeeds to command under service regulation, thereby satisfying the reasonableness requirement of the Fourth Amendment.
Right, confusing the cases, but then under Bunting, isn't it the case that even if she didn't have all aspects of a commander, that she could have some aspects of a commander, and that would be enough for this?
That's correct, Your Honor, and we see that in RCM 401 Alpha, for example, where you have commanders who satisfy the definition of a commander under 315D1, but they don't have courts martial convening authority over certain cases. But it is our position here that the executive officer succeeded to full command and that she did have courts martial convening authority. But even if this court disagrees with us, we don't think that that's dispositive because we think that 401 Alpha and Bunting support certain circumstances where somebody can be a commander under 315D1 and still not have courts martial convening authority.
I have no further questions.
Judge Olson.
Chief Judge, I have no questions at this time.
Judge Sparks.
I think counsel, if I'm right, as I recall, sure, wasn't the basic distinction between impermissible delegation and permissible devolution of command. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so your position, obviously, is that this was a permissible devolution of command authority.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So can you tell me why, in your view, the CPA spends a lot of time talking about regulations and the attributes of command, and they don't really get into that distinction as much. And in fact, they say this case is distinguishable from Cal Schumer. What do you have to say about that point?
And I'm sorry, Your Honor, are you referring to the lower court's opinion?
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes.
Okay. So what, I mean, one thing that we do agree with the lower court is that designation of a unit and designation of the executive officer as an OIC did not happen here. And that their citation to Navy General Regulations 0722 and 0723 are an apposite for that reason. The only regulation that is really relevant here is 1026. And under that regulation, when a commander is absent, the executive officer succeeds to command. So the point that we disagree with the lower court is that the lower court found that Lieutenant Colonel White was never absent from the command. But we think that there are two points that make that conclusion erroneous. The first is that the facts indisputably show that Lieutenant Colonel White, attached to a separate command, gained a new reporting senior and deployed under special purpose MAGTF under central command. And two, the cases that deal with devolution of search authority deal with a functional absence. So even if the CCA is correct to say that Lieutenant Colonel White was always with or near the squadron because 300 Marines deployed with him, that's not dispositive because the precedent is clear that the absence is a functional one and not a geographic or physical proximity. And the record shows that Lieutenant Colonel White was functionally absent from the command because he was not executing duties on behalf of the squadron. The squadron's mission was to provide aviation ground support to the 3rd MAW units back in Miramar, and that's not what he was doing at the time of the search request.
Thank you. I have no further questions.
Judge Maddox.
Thank you. Lieutenant Rios, reading the briefs, the government's position appears to be that Colonel White was absent and Major B was in command, and the appellee's position appears to be that Colonel White remained in command the whole time. Is there any in-between position such that that Major B could be in command of only the left-behind unit, and that would be a permissible devolution, that you could devolve to be in command of a portion of a unit?
No, Your Honor. I think Bunting makes it clear that when a successor succeeds to command, they accede to the command as a whole. However, I think Bunting does recognize certain circumstances where portions of the functions of command devolve to one person and portions of the other functions of command can devolve to a second person. But I mean, it's our position here that the executive officer succeeded to full command because Lieutenant Colonel White was not executing any duties for the squadron after he deployed. The only indication that shows any connection of Lieutenant Colonel White to the squadron was the back brief that he would receive from the executive officer. But the record clearly shows that those back briefs were simply to make him aware of what was going on in the squadron, and that all of the decisions, operational, military justice, and administrative, were being made by the executive officer.
And is there no evidence that he did anything in the time he was gone to command the
the stay-behind unit?
Yes, Your Honor. So, I mean, in addition to the back brief, the record does show that Lieutenant Colonel White referred charges in April shortly after he deployed to a court-martial. But, again, I think because the question of whether or not command devolves to an executive officer, I mean, that is a legal conclusion. And to the extent that the parties exercised caution or took extra measures to ensure that the referral was appropriate, I mean, their subjective and, in fact, mistaken belief that she didn't have court-martial authority doesn't negate the otherwise correct legal conclusion that she was the commander of the squadron and that she had court-martial convening authority.
I have no additional questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, in your brief, you quote the Marine Corps Manual, paragraph 10072B, when a commander is absent and has not directed succession to command during that absence, the officer who would otherwise succeed to command, i.e. executive officers, shall be commander for purposes of military justice, emergencies, and other unforeseen circumstances requiring action. So he purports to withhold military justice authority, and in fact, as was just pointed out, referred charges on his own during his absence. But the commander, which doesn't turn on the has not directed succession to command language, is that broad enough to let him pull military justice authority, as he certainly explicitly purported to do?
No, Your Honor. I mean, again, we think that the regulations are the sole governing determinative factor, whether or not an executive...
Well, there's a regulation which leaves the thing totally ambiguous.
Yes, Your Honor. Pardon me, Your Honor. And just to clarify, the record shows that Lieutenant Colonel White and his reporting senior agreed that she would not have court-martial convening authority, but the reason was not spelled out in the record. Lieutenant Colonel White, when he testified, he said that he believed he didn't have authority to give her that those authorities. So, I mean, the record doesn't show that he didn't want her to have court-martial convening
authority. The point is not what he wanted. The point was that in the record, he explicitly withheld it.
Absolutely. It seems to me like the CCA says it's all or nothing. Either she has all the adverse of command or she can't, or it can't, this authority to grant a warrant can't devolve to her. Right? And you're trying to make the argument that no, everything devolved. She did have the full authority of command, therefore it devolved to her. And I thought that the test from our case law was the question is whether she was functioning as a commander in connection with the command decision then being made at the time and place in question. And the command decision that was being made at the time and place in question was whether to grant the search authorization. Correct or not correct?
Absolutely correct, Your Honor, and thank you for your question. I think that question appropriately focuses the analysis where it belongs, and that's in July.
But I also think that this goes to the question that Judge Maddox asked, which isn't there some middle ground, which is it doesn't have to be all, or as you were trying to argue, or nothing, all or nothing. It could be for purposes of this command decision. And she was the person that was there being asked to make the decision. And he was not there. And they didn't ask him.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And again, our position is that full command devolved, but certainly there are, again, 401 Alpha contemplates scenarios where a commander doesn't have court-martial convening authority but can still issue search authorizations under MRE 315D1. So, again, regardless of whether or not she has court-martial convening authority, we think that under MRE 315D1, she still satisfies that requirement and the search authorization was still valid. Because it's clear that under CalSHR, at the time and place that the search request was made, she was, in fact, a person who was exercising general command responsibilities.
Counsel, I'd like to ask a question. This ties into what you're discussing right here. Now, let's assume for the purposes of this question that we were to rule in your favor. I'm, of course, not predicting anything. How would we craft an opinion that would be helpful to the field here? I mean, this is a very common scenario. It's a very important scenario. If we wanted to be constructive and clear rather than complicated and confusing, how would we craft an opinion that people in the field would be able to grasp and readily apply to know whether for military justice purposes, specifically for search and seizure purposes, whether a individual has that authority or not?
I think the rule, Your Honor, would be when an executive officer succeeds to command in the absence of a commander, that both satisfies a reasonableness requirement of the Fourth Amendment and it satisfies the needs of the services to have continuous streams of authority.
Does that standard, however, limit beyond our prior case law when a person has search and seizure authority? Would we not be, based on your standard right there, would we not be restricting our prior case law?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I mean, the case law says that you look at the time and place that the search request was made, and you look at the person who is exercising general command responsibilities, and it almost always that person is exercising general command responsibilities because the commander is absent. So, again, and that's just as a, when you have those facts in place, as a legal conclusion, that means that at the time and place, command had already devolved to an executive officer. So to try to get it as clear as a bright line rule, it's really just Kelscher. The person who is exercising general command responsibilities in the commander's absence at the time and place of the search request is authorized to issue search authorization. And, Your Honor, do you have any more questions?
What if the commander is not absent? What if the commander is just at the rifle range or doing a gas mask training or something like that?
Well, Your Honor, the precedent is clear that absence is not a geographical or a temporal measure. So it's a functional absence. And when we look at functional absence, it's relative to the mission set of a command. So we see two different scenarios where a commander can be functionally absent in this court's precedent. The first is when a commander is exercising duties that are unrelated or separate from the command, and we saw that in Bunting and Azelton and Kelscher. And the other way that a commander can be functionally absent from the command is when they're not exercising any duties at all. If they're with their family or they're watching a play. I mean, we saw that in Murray, Law, and Bradley. So it's more a focus on, again, and it's not a focus on geographic, temporal, or even whether or not they have communication abilities. It's what is the commander doing at that time? Is he functionally absent? Who is exercising command responsibilities when the commander is not?
Well, is it all command responsibility or is it command responsibility with respect to the function at issue at the time and place?
It's command responsibility with respect to the command, and the time period that we look at is at the time and place of the search request. And again, even if this court doesn't find that Lieutenant Colonel White was functionally absent, I mean, we think that the fact that he did attach to a separate command is also a determinative factor for the application of good faith. Here, it's clear that the agents, they routed investigations to the executive officer as the acting commander. They routed her the probable cause affidavit and titled it as commander of the Marine Wing Support Squadron. And the military just found that the executive officer was employed in substantially the same way as the other squadron commanders. The agents also knew that Lieutenant Colonel White had deployed, and they knew that they needed a commander to grant their search authorization. So given all of those facts, it's clear that the agents here reasonably believe that the executive officer was a commander, and they relied in good faith on that search authorization. And even if this court doesn't find the application of the good faith exception applies here, we think that MRA 311A3 does apply because, again, there's no evidence whatsoever that the agents here acted in a deliberate or a reckless or a grossly negligent way to circumvent the appellee's Fourth Amendment rights. I mean, they knew that they needed a search authorization granted by their commander, and they knew
This is Judge Sparks. Can I interrupt you for just a minute? I know your time is waning. I'm just curious, was this a situation where a military magistrate was not available? Because the record indicates so, because I'm not asking you to necessarily speculate or testify. Does the record indicate that the reason why they wanted a commander in this case, as opposed to going to a military magistrate, is that there wasn't a military magistrate? And I know some places there aren't necessarily magistrates available. Do you know, or does the record so indicate?
No, Your Honor, the record doesn't indicate that. What the record does show is that the agents knew that they could have requested their search authorization from the senior command, the commander of Marine Aircraft Group 11, and they knew that they could seek authorization from the installation commander. I mean, but they didn't because they thought that the executive officer was the commander of the squadron.
Yeah, I understand. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Unless this court has any further questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel for the defense.
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning, Chief Judge Suki, members of the court, may it please the court, I am Tammy Mitchell, and along with Lieutenant Clifton Morgan, we represent Master Sergeant Roberto Armendariz. Navy Marine Court recognized multiple egregious Fourth Amendment violations, took appropriate action, and provided appropriate guidance for how the government can avoid the pitfalls of this case in future cases. This case also gives this court the opportunity to bring the doctrine of devolution of command into the 21st century with modern communications technology. This court should affirm the Navy Marine Court's well-reasoned opinion for four reasons. Number one, for the first time before this court, the government is arguing that command authority devolved to Major Benbow only on, Major B, only on 26 July 2016, which is also different from its argument this morning, when its previous argument at trial and before the Navy Marine Court was that Major Benbow was acting as the commander of the Remain Behind element for the duration of the Lieutenant Colonel's deployment, which is contrary to the government's argument in United States versus Alexander that Lieutenant Colonel White remains the commander throughout his deployment. Under these circumstances, this court should consider the government's argument about devolution waived. Two, the Navy Marine Court correctly held that command authority did not devolve to Major B. Three, unlike the military judge, the Navy Marine Court conducted an extensive hearing analysis and appropriately determined the benefits of a strong deterrent effect outweighed the cost of suppressing evidence in this one case. Four, unlike the military judge, the Navy Marine Court correctly relied on the unambiguous plain language of the first prong of the good faith exception that requires the person authorizing the search and seizure of evidence to actually be competent. And this was a point that the government conceded at trial in its brief that the good faith exception might not apply. And that's at JA 247. Under Custis, this court should decline to do what the government is asking it to do, adding language to a codified rule of evidence to delete the plain language requirement of a competent authority. As this court wisely recognized in Custis, that is a matter for policymakers, not the courts. Finally, this court does not even need to address the third certified issue because the government cannot meet the third prong of the good faith exception, and therefore it does not apply. Subject to the court's questions, that concludes my opening statement.
Thank you. Counsel, we look at good faith in the context of the law enforcement people asking for the authorization. And here you have Major B, who is the exec, no question about that. And the lieutenant colonel is gone. There's no question about that. And they don't know the intricacies of devolution where this is and who's got this authority and is it a brooding omnipresence in the sky. So why isn't that enough for good faith?
Well, Your Honor, first of all,
I realize that the rule itself requires to trigger good faith that the person's got to be competent. But go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. So law enforcement agents, in order to enforce the law, I mean, they are required to know the law and follow it. The other issue is whether their actions were reasonable. And as the defense pointed out during the litigation at trial, these were not brand new agents. These were veteran agents. And with the lieutenant colonel in at the time, he was in Kuwait, and that's at in the JA pages 98, 99, 106. So he's in Kuwait with full communications capabilities. It would have been extremely easy to contact him, phone, email, text, whatever, and say, hey, I need you to do this. Additionally, the cases look at whether there was any consultation with any JAG officers, both when it comes to the how to create a command, a unit for Major B to command, which there wasn't, and then also whether the agents consulted with any JAG about the situation. And in this particular case, and this distinguishes this case from Perkins, there's a curious lack of any consultation.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Judge Rye.
So, counsel, just as I understand, because Colonel W., even though he was in Kuwait in a different time zone and deployed, could have potentially been reached by phone or email, that's what had to happen? Or if it could happen, then he could never be absent? He's not functionally absent?
Your Honor, when we look at...
The command function can never devolve as long as there's some way to reach someone.
The question is whether... I'm sorry.
My question is the one I would like you to answer.
Yes. No, I apologize, Your Honor. It is, was he reachable? And under Kalscher, Bradley, and Murray, that was one of the factors that this court looked at, whether the commander was reachable. And with the motion to suppress, the government had the burden of proving by preponderance of the evidence that not only was Major B the commander at that moment, but also that Lieutenant Colonel White was unreachable. And the testimony from his own testimony was he was reachable.
I have no further questions.
Judge Olson.
Counsel, you were just talking about the phrase you used was it was extremely easy to contact the colonel. I just question whether that's an accurate representation of the situation. I mean, if we're talking about JAGs, yeah. I mean, that's their job to be reachable for legal issues. We're talking about someone who's been forward deployed on the other side of the world who is in a number of different countries, one presumes is doing very important stuff having to do with our allies and the sense of our allies in this nation. Isn't it a little cavalier just to say that a person in that, a senior person such as the colonel here, deployed, that he should drop everything because he's getting a phone call from the states about some search and seizure issue that could be handled in a different way?
Two answers, Your Honor. First, he remains functional as the commander because he withheld NJC authority and courts martial convening authority to himself and took the time to instruct Major B to sign the referral charges against Sergeant Alexander. The second point is Lieutenant Colonel W is the one who said he was in fact reachable. So then choosing not to make any effort, and again, in light of modern communications technology, that they made no effort whatsoever to contact him, and then to go to one of at least three other commanders who were at Miramar. That shows it was a matter of not wanting to inconvenience him. But then this court pointed out in Kalsher, if commanders are too busy not to do these really important to make these really important decisions, then maybe Congress should rethink having commanders involved.
I believe my time's expired, so I'll follow up later.
Judge Sparks.
Good morning, Ms. Mitchell. I'd like to talk a little bit about Rule 311A3. And, or at least that's part of the rule. For exclusion, would result in appreciable deterrence of future unlawful searches and seizures and benefit the deterrent effect of the exclusionary rule. But I noticed that your take on this part of the analysis and the CCA's take is a bit different. And the CCA raises a bunch of, some of them are kind of Scrivener's errors, and they complain, criticize the agents for not taking care and writing the thing with the authorization or the affidavit, subsequent authorization with enough specificity. But you took a different position, at least in your brief, and you say this will encourage commanders and agents to consult with their respective judge advocates. Can you tell me why that you're not kind of adopting the lower court's view on the purposes of the exclusionary rule and why suppressing this evidence advances those purposes?
Well, Your Honor, when we look at the agents...
In other words, what is it you think suppressing this evidence deters?
With respect to Special Agent Isaac Perez in particular, he had a history of Fourth Amendment violations. And this is documented in Tienter, where...
My point is, what does all this have to do with the fact that it was presented to someone who might not have been the proper authority? If the complaint is that this is the person who authorized the search was not competent, was not the proper authority, what is it you're trying to deter?
We are trying to encourage. And so with respect to commanders or people acting as commanders, we would actually submit this to this court for consideration, whether the exclusionary rule should be extended to them. I think the facts of this particular case warrant it, and certainly the court was looking at, I think, holistically the problem in this particular case, that had there been consultation with Jay on, you know, how can we divide the squadron up so that Major B has her own bona fide unit, who has authorities. The delegation letter that she received did not include key command functions.
A lot of the things that the CCA talks about and that you talk about in your brief with respect to, you know, promoting the purposes of the exclusionary rule could apply in any case. I mean, if the issue, the main complaint here, I thought, is that this is all an issue because you have an improper authority granting a search authorization. So if that's the main complaint, which apparently it seems to be, then excluding the evidence in this case would do what? I'm stuck with how this could, you know, deter them from having, but acting mistakenly in another case, or what?
Counsel, your time, Judge Sparks' time is up. I would ask that question be reserved for our free-for-all.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Judge Maggs.
Good morning, Ms. Mitchell. Can I ask you about what's in the record with regard to whether Colonel White was reachable almost instantaneously? That's the assertion that's made in your brief, and then in the reply brief, the government says there's really nothing in the record that would justify the conclusion that he was almost instantly reachable. What is the evidence for that?
Your Honor, it's at the Joint Appendix, pages 98, 99, and 106, where Lieutenant Colonel White testified that at the time he was in Kuwait for about a week, and he had full communications capabilities. And then he also testified the only time that he was not readily available was when he was in Iraq, and that's at JA 96. We also have testimony from Major B that she briefed him on this case, including the authorization and what the agents retrieved from Master Sergeant Armendariz's office at JA 116. So under the circumstances, he was reachable. They just simply chose not to contact him. And I think GNet specifically looked to that. And
do you suppose that they failed to contact him because she was in command of the rear element?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
I said, do you suppose that they failed to contact him because she was in command of the rear element?
No, Your Honor. She was not in command, and the rear element was not an actual unit. She was using authority that had been delegated to her in this letter, which was permissible by the SECNAV instructions, you know, to sign for awards and reenlistment packages. She testified that signed security rosters, but that was part of her job as a security officer. So when we look at what does the function of command mean, under the Marine Corps manual, 1006, if I could have just a moment, Your Honor.
Yes.
1006 1D, inherent features in the office of command. Fourth feature is the authority to initiate or apply authorized disciplinary measures, and there's no dispute. He had no authority whatsoever. When it comes to devolution command versus a delegation of authority, a delegation is the piecemealing of different authorities, whereas devolution of command, and this court held this in Williams, this is at 19 CMR 369-372, the officer assuming command must necessarily become vested with all of the prerogatives and duties of that office.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Chief Judge, could I ask...
Go ahead, Judge Maggs.
Yeah, I just want to ask a second follow-up question just very quickly. And, you know, it seems to me that if you look at a case like Kalshoyer, where the commander is just out of contact for a very short period, we could have devolution of command. And whether or not Colonel White was still in command or not of this unit, I mean, wouldn't the real question be in this case just was at that specific time if he was out of command? I mean, if he was attending a play or viewing a missile site or something like that at the very time, wouldn't under Kalshoyer we have devolution?
I think the answer is no, and I think if Kalshoyer had been decided today, that the outcome would be different.
Are you suggesting we should overrule Kalshoyer?
No, we don't. This court does not have to overrule Kalshoyer. All we are suggesting is that this court bring Kalshoyer and law into the 21st century based on, you know, modern communications technology.
Back in the day, based on modern technology, I just want to make sure I understand your position. So they're in strictly within the context of devolution. There were no additional steps, no additional circumstances, in your view, that would have or should have resulted in devolution here?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Barbs, I had to cut you off. Do you want to finish your question?
No, I think I'm not going to take more of counsel's time. But let me ask a different question. Maybe this is kind of related. The issues and instances or points that you bring up on that part of the analysis in your brief dealing with the exclusionary rule and its purpose, the deterrence, were those things brought up at the trial? I assume they were in a separate motion. Were they not?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so could you and your client have appealed here anyway, complaining about the military judge's decision here on appeal on those particular issues, specificity of the warrant, overbreadth, you know, of the search, or any of that? Couldn't you have simply appealed those issues here?
Your Honor, we did not bring this particular appeal to this court.
I understand that. But in your own separate right to appeal, could you not have appealed those issues dealing with the military judge's rulings regarding other aspects of the search authorization?
If I may have a moment, Your Honor.
I mean, you could have. You could have just exercised your right to appeal, right?
Your Honor, Master Sergeant Armendariz prevailed at the Navy Marine Corps. There would be no basis to appeal to this court.
Right, but I mean, you still could have cross-appealed, couldn't you, knowing that the government was coming forward with this issue, and you knew you. forward as part of your argument. Couldn't you have done that?
No, Your Honor. There was nothing for us to appeal.
All right. Thank you.
Counsel, you may proceed.
With respect to the question about the deterrent effect, the deterrent effect is to force the agent's hand to take steps to ensure they are seeking authorization from competent authorities. A call to any one of the available judge advocates or the other commanders at Miramar or even the trial counsel could have solved this problem. And this is a factor that the court, this court has looked at. It looked at it in Perkins and it actually looked at it in Chapel, where even though the captain, there was an issue of jurisdiction, this court found that he was, in fact, a commander, and he was acting on the advice of his SJA. And he consulted with his SJA about that particular issue, and he had general authority to authorize searches. And again, in this particular case, there is no consultation with any JAG whatsoever.
Counsel, I have a question of a metaphysical nature. Is command divisible? There's a long arching question in political science as to whether sovereignty is divisible. Is command divisible?
No, it is not, Your Honor. You are either a commander or you're not.
Well, no, that's really not. The question is, can there be two commanders of X at the same time?
No. And the reason for that, I believe our amicus pointed out, addressed that particular issue in their brief. If you have two people who both claim to be commanders and then they give conflicting orders, which order is the service member supposed to follow?
It's like Sparta with its two kings. They took turns. Go ahead, counsel.
And, you know, it violates the military principle of unity of command.
One would think so. Go ahead.
Also, additionally, the record reflected an agent who testified at the suppression hearing said they have a checklist of steps that they take, but apparently finding out, you know, whether the person had authority wasn't the first item on that particular list. And I understand that they pointed to, you know, their previous interactions with her in providing her ROIs. But the agents do the same thing with trial counsel. And, you know, giving an officer an ROI to review does not make a trial counsel a commander. So, and again, the standard is reasonableness. The third prong of the good faith exception does not apply. And therefore, the exception itself does not apply, because when we look at the agent's conduct in requesting the authorization, if I could have just one more.
Yes. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. So when we look at the grossly negligent, reckless, or intentional misconduct by the agent, Agent Perez requesting authorization to search every single vehicle registered to Master Sergeant Armendariz and to search every single file in a phone, Major B authorizing these requests, seizing two phones when there had only been one, and there's
well,
any...
Counsel, I don't see where you're going. I don't know that the overbreadth of the request or going beyond its, the limits of the authorization is before us. I do have a question about the exclusionary rule. And the exclusionary rule is supposed to deter police misconduct. I think everyone could agree that this tangled command situation, whatever we end up making of it, is not very a very desirable one. But can we use the exclusionary rule to deter sloppy command authority, sloppy treatment of command authority? I'm not so sure.
Hello?
Hello? You're breaking up. I can't hear you.
Oh.
You're breaking up.
We can't understand you.
Hello? Can you hear me now?
Yes. Thank you.
Okay. I think there is a different call coming in. So I believe the Navy Marine Corps opinion regarding a deterrent effect on commanders, that was simply guidance that we would hope that, that the courts provide to the field to avoid pitfalls in future cases, such as what happened in this case. So we understand the case law does not currently extend the exclusionary rule to commanders, but certainly we would ask this court to submit that issue to this court for consideration and I think that under the circumstances of this particular case, that would be appropriate, but certainly not necessary, and that's not something that the Navy Marine Corps hung their hat on.
Thank you, Counsel. Thank you. Your time has expired. Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. I just have 3 points. The first, I would just like to clarify that the government did not concede that the good faith exception does not apply. The brief states, it says on that same page, on Joint Appendix 247, is that the good faith exception, while it may not apply, that Chapel would indicate that it could apply. Second, the appellee requests this court to reexamine 41 years of precedent that has already concluded that the exclusionary rule is not extended to commanders without explicitly asking this court to overrule Easel or Lopez. And third, in regards to reconciling Kalscher with technology, the precedent is clear that assumption of command is not predicated on the availability of the individual who has relinquished command. And in fact, as Appellee notes, Kalscher and Murray, they found that commanders were reachable, but they nevertheless found that command still devolved. And while modern times has changed technology, the demands of warfighting have not changed, and this court should reverse the lower court.
Counsel, let me ask you the same metaphysical question. Is command divisible?
Yes, Your Honor. We think that command can be divisible, as shown in Bunting and as shown in RCM 401 Alpha.
You can have two people sharing command of the same unit at the same time.
Yes, I mean, as we see in Bunting, there can be one person who is exercising operational functions of command, and there can be another person who is exercising administrative functions of command.
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. Barring any further questions from this court should reverse the lower court. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Court thanks Counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted, and the court is in recess pending further order of the court.